may or may not be familiar to you. The great controversy has ended. Sin and sinners are no more. The entire universe is clean. One pulse of harmony and gladness beats through the vast creation. For him who created all, full of life and light and gladness throughout the realms of limitable space. From the minutest atom to the greatest world, all things animate and inanimate, in their unshadowed beauty and perfect joy, declare that God is love. It's the end of the great controversy. Page 628. We see that what was lost will be restored. We found that the covenant of life, harmony, and humanity with God is back. It's what gets humanity back to this point, is the covenant. It's why I find it so important, I guess, and so, so earth-shattering for me to be able to look at the covenant in its true language, in its unmasked form. So for the past weeks, we've been shown what the covenant looks like, what it looks like in the midst of the brokenness and destruction that we placed upon it. And I want you to note, we've noted that he's maintained his presence through it, through all of the mistrust and the distrust that humanity now has for him. The harmony has been broken, but been broken by others. And I like being reminded that one day it will be completely restored again. But they no longer trust, we no longer trust, we now fear. And fear caused a new DNA to be produced within us. One that seeks to self-protect, self-preserve, at the cost of other selves. Even the changes of the nature of harmony, especially in the years following the flood. In the years following the flood, after the drama of Noah and his wine and one of his sons, we see that immediately the flood really did nothing for our nature, did it? And it says this in the next, as the waters recede, the whole earth had what? One language and the same words. The Hebrew word is literally lip. The whole earth had one lip, one mouth, if you will. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks, fire them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord said, look, they are one people. They have one language, and it's only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. I just read how the great controversy ends. It ends with harmony, right? It ends with a complete harmony. Well, this sounds like harmony. Right? They have one language. They're all united in what? They're all united in their language. They have one purpose, to build a city and a tower, to create a name for themselves. They are unified in that. Sounds like harmony to me. But God says, look, this is only the beginning of this particular harmony. It isn't the language or the tower. Is what I'll put forth to you today as we continue God's covenant amidst the destruction, now amidst the receding waters of the destruction. We come to Babel. I think it's important to study this because immediately we were shown after the flood that the mistrust and the distrust would continue, that man's nature really hasn't changed. Noah and his sons are proof of that. And as they begin to populate, as God told them to do, then why should we look at this? Why is it important to see that the covenant still has to exist within here? I think it's important to study because the way that we're told here is that this is the whole earth. This is everybody we're talking about. If you remember what made the desperation, if you will, after 10 generations after the fall, what made the desperation so completely desperate is that we were down to 8 heartbeats. All of humanity was 8 heartbeats away from being completely exterminated by our own selfish nature, by our own sin. And the flood comes and it buys us time. It kind of resets the clock a little for us. It's going to get us somewhere. But notice this, the whole world comes together one more time immediately. Actually, it's about 10 generations, which is, to me, kind of ironic. From the fall to the flood, it took 10 generations. And now 10 generations, the whole earth is united again. And I think that's why it's so, I guess, urgent for us to look at. What's the covenant look like when one more time humanity stands up and looks at God and says, we don't want to live by your covenant. We don't trust you. I am naked, so I am afraid. Where is the covenant when humanity tells him again to get out of their face? So who are these people? It says they're the descendants of Noah. They are the survivors of the flood. Noah lived 300 years after the flood. His sons lived over 500 years after the flood. They are the eyewitnesses. And their children are the generations, about 10 of them, again, if you count them in Scripture, by the way. Every generation, I think we've looked at this before, every generation has that one shadow in which they were raised in. In other words, it kind of encompasses all of our values and everything that we were. The greatest generation, the baby boomer generation, they grew up in the shadow of the Depression and World War II. Our generation comes along a little later. We grew up in the shadow of the Civil Rights Movement in Vietnam and the unrest within here. Those are long shadows. Those are shadows that affect pretty much every way, the way that we think. And it affects our values. It affects how we live them out. It affects how we look and see how we fit in a community within church and living in a country in which we live. The shadow of the flood had to be a pretty, pretty impressive shadow, don't you think? What do you think it was like being one of Ham, Japheth's, or being one of Noah's grandchildren? What do you think bedtime stories were like? A pretty heavy shadow to be raised in, if you will. So you think the tower of the product, do you think the tower is a product of that? I can tell you what Noah's grandchildren's bedtime stories were like because here they are. Do they trust God any more than the people who came before their grandfather did? The language of the tower tells us exactly how thick that shadow was. The language of the tower tells how that fear continues. That fear continues, and it shows in the building of the tower, or even coming up with the idea of the building of the tower. It's built in the land of Shinar. Interesting. Do we remember who settled Shinar? It's found in a place called Babel. I shared this with you when I introduced us to mankind's new nature and its results. Remember, I told you that we would look at this again. Genesis 10 tells us how the descendants of Noah's son began to settle the land around them. This is the way that it sounds. From these, the coastland people spread. These are the descendants of Japheth in their lands, with their own language, by their families, in the nations. So they began to settle by how? Begin to settle by tribe. J Japheth's relatives are said that they were kind of begin to settle in a particular land. But then there's a descendant of Japheth's brother, Ham. And it says, Cush became the father of Nimrod. He was the first on earth to become a mighty warrior. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. He's the first one to be praised for being a mighty hunter, a warrior. We don't know really what that is by that verse, but his actions might tell us a little bit more. The beginning of his kingdom was what? Was Babel, or Babel. Erech, Akkad, Calmet in the land of what? In the land of Shinar. And from that land, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Kala, risen between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city. He's the first one to look around, look over there, and say, I'm going to take what I want. Forget the boundaries. Forget who we are. If I can take it, I should have it. His actions tell us what a mighty hunter means. He's the first one to look next door and say, I kind of like that. I'm going to take it. And he seems to be praised for it. Nimrod was considered mighty because he took what he wanted. He was the one that established Babel. Which brings us to our narrative today. They said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top where? Its top in the heavens. By the way, who is ever building this tower, they're not satisfied with just dominating whatever's happening on earth, building a great city. Who do they want to dominate? All we know is that the guy that destroyed this place lives right there. We're going to go get him. In the spirit of Nimrod, a mighty hunter in God's face, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The language tells us something's up about Nimrod in the spirit of Nimrod. He embodies completely the new human nature. He embodies completely the idea, the evolutionary nature of what man has become. Only the strong one survives. And only the strong thrive. And if you're strong enough, and you're unified enough, you can do anything. In fact, maybe even to make sure that God never, ever does it again, why don't we just go take care of them? And if we don't make a name for ourselves, these people say, we shall be scattered where? Everywhere. So the tower is in the land that Nimrod established. There's been speculation, Jewish and Christian speculation forever, that says that it was Nimrod who actually began building the tower. It was his idea, if you will. We don't have evidence of that. It doesn't say so in the Bible. And again, it's just, it's his nature. And if it isn't him himself, it certainly is the nature that he passed on to his descendants, to his generations, if you will. The ziggurats, the temples of ancient Mesopotamian worship, pretty well have accepted these stepped pyramids, which is what ziggurat means in Akkadian. Long staircases to the top, if you will. Long staircases up, and at the very top was always a shrine to the god, with a door in it that literally means doorway to God, Av El, a doorway into the face of God. Archaeology has found hundreds of these ziggurats that were worshipped at the time of the ancient Mesopotamians. And it isn't too far to speculate to say that maybe, just maybe, all of them were designed after the tower. And that they were created for the same purpose. There are some of these branches of this worship, too, that has proof that had Nimrod's name in it, that he was one of the gods that they worshipped. The mighty hunter or the warrior before the Lord made him divine. The tower wasn't just to escape the floodwaters. the best way to keep this God from flooding us again would be to build a stairway right to heaven, send our best and strongest and our most ruthless, and have him take care of that God. The new creation, the new paradigm of power, always finds its solution in force, always finds its solution in violence. This is the spirit of humanity today. Driven by the fear, no longer having the faith in God's promise. So for Nimrod to live out this ultimate being against God or being in God's face, this harmony is a living out of their new nature. It's self-preservation. And why? Why this fear of God? They just don't trust him. They have not trusted him ever since their first parents, our first parents, decided that they would no longer trust him. That he is somebody to fear. There is a reason to fear. By the way, the covenant is going to eventually begin to deal with this in the way that it's plain to see that what came before the fear was guilt. Adam, what is it you've done? It wasn't me, it was the woman. They've never dealt with their what? They've never dealt with their guilt. And if you don't deal with your guilt, then what you fear is whatever you believe the consequences are that are right around the corner. They've never dealt with their guilt. And none of their children have dealt with their guilt. So they all decide to fear. And they all decide to act on this fear. Adam and Eve no longer trust him. They pass that on. That nature of fear is passed on to all of us as relatives. That nature now that we're born with. That's original sin, by the way. Not that you and I participated in the disobedience of Adam and Eve, in their transgression, but we were born with their nature. I haven't said this in a while, as a matter of fact, I don't think I've used it in this study. Humanity. If you think about it, even humanity in what we would consider its purest form are the most selfish creatures on the planet. We debate, and the church debated, whether or not babies are sinners. How many here believe babies are sinners? I do. Babies are sinners because they're born with whose nature? If you don't think a baby is a sinner, let me ask you this. Did your baby care how much sleep you got? Does your baby care whether or not you can afford the food and clothing that they're demanding? And when a baby demands something, they want it when? Yesterday. Now, a baby may not have transgressed. A baby may not be able to transgress. And in that way, they are pure. But their nature is what? Selfish. That's original sin. We believe in the doctrine of original sin, not the doctrine of original transgression. The most selfish creature on the planet is a human baby. Second most selfish, the human teenager. Then comes the human retiree. So Noah's family trusted him enough to be saved from their first death. That's as far as Noah's family's trust goes, by the way. One thing that we leave out in the flood is that we talk about flood and we talk about salvation. Let me add this, as far as Scripture is concerned. The only thing that we know about the people that died in the flood was that they died the first death. Right? Do we know that they're lost? No, we do not. They died the first death, as who else is going to? As we will. That's all we know. That's all we know, right? So all Noah's family trusted, all those 8 heartbeats trusted, was to get on the ark to save themselves from the first death. Yes, they experienced salvation, but they only experienced it from the first death for a while. Because even Noah and his sons die eventually. You with me on the language? You'd be very careful. But when we talk about salvation, we don't know, do we?
Could there be antediluvians in the kingdom?
Yes.
But if you don't think there should be, you better be good with it when you get there and you find that they're there.
Right?
Okay. So that's all we know that how Noah's family trusted. They trusted enough to be saved from their first death in the flood. They guaranteed that they would not die in the flood. But that's all. After, the generations who come after don't trust God any more than that at all. When he tells them that they have nothing to fear, when it was all over, he says, when I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you. The covenant, which is what we happen to be studying. I will remember the covenant, and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. If trust of God is still out of the question that he won't destroy with the flood, then who will they look to? Nimrod. Somebody who says, I have a solution, but we all got to come together to do it. Tower that fulfills all their needs. Distance from the floods. A way to defy, or at the least, to actually hunt God and kill him themselves. It's a sign of the fallen reinterpretation of harmony. What happens when the individual's fear is shared? What happens when the individual's fear is passed on? Fear, we no longer trust God. We draw in, then, in order to protect ourselves against this God that we no longer trust. Begin to trust in our own evolution to take care of that and make us safe. But harmony isn't the problem here. It's the ultimate purpose of it. Because the ultimate purpose is involves who? It involves the whole world. We're back to the days of Noah. It involves everyone. One language and the same words. Language, communication, that's a good thing, being able to communicate, amen? It isn't the language. It's not, that isn't the problem. It's the reason that they've come together to communicate. They are communicating continually their mistrust of God, their fear of God. And that they got somebody who can take care of it. They had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Bitumen is it could be translated as tar. A couple chapters later, you're going to find out that the Valley of Siddim was full of tar pits. Wow! Technology! They looked and they said, that stuff out there, that black sticky stuff, that sticks bricks together. How about that? How about when you bake mud, it comes up with bricks? That is pretty cool. It isn't the technology that's the problem. It's the purpose. It's the harmony that they're looking for. It's the protection that they're looking for. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower. Why? Let us make a name for ourselves. Let us build ourselves. Let us make a name. God doesn't have a problem with being unified in communicating. Doesn't have a problem being unified in purpose. Doesn't have a problem with humanity finding technology that could better themselves. He has no problem with that. You have to ask then what this purpose is that seems to have gotten under God's skin. Adam, Eve, then Noah, God said to all of them, what he wants is their friendship. The covenant is about walking and talking. God came walking in the cool of the day, in the evening, in the garden. The relationship is built on what? The relationship is built as every friendship is built on. It is built on trust. Actually, it's built on free will, then trust. Remember, friendships are the only relationships in which you and I choose. We choose to be friends. We don't choose our relatives. Which means if you can choose somebody to be your friend, you can always then choose to what? You can always choose to trust them. It's done freely. Then they decide based on that truth, based on that trust. These folks are all basing their actions on fear and mistrust. Nimrod is speaking for them. Same lip, same words. No one is speaking with God based on faith. Nobody is looking to trust God. They're living out their recreation of His creation. We are back to the days before the flood. Humanity is on the verge of what? It's on the verge of extinction again. And it took about 10 generations. Let us make humans in our image, God says, in our likeness. He formed them out of the dust of the ground, and then He breathed into them the breath of life. He made an intimate connection with them that could not be broken. Well, I shouldn't say that. It shouldn't be broken. It's right here. The intimacy, that how He created us in our likeness, He says. He created us with that free will, which means He created us with the ability to be able to love Him and to love each other, created in His image. Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness. Nimrod says, no, let us make a name for ourselves. Because I don't trust that Creator who created us in His image. And by the way, that image is weak. It's going to get us killed. Humanity was created by God in His image with free will to love. Humanity recreates it, takes away free will, and gives it away to the strong. Makes people become friends. Makes people have relationships. Makes people worship. Humanity says no to God now. We want to be recreated in our image. Self-preservation, self-protection, evolutionary way of getting things done. Might makes right. Because God says, be fruitful and multiply to all the earth, He tells Adam and Eve. By the way, even gives them the same instructions after the fall. And then after the flood in Genesis 9:7, you be fruitful and what? Multiply, abound on the earth. Why? Because God knows what will happen when they come together. And guess what? They ignore Him and come together. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad the face of the whole earth. Everything God attempts to accomplish through the covenant is seen as a threat because they don't trust Him. Everything that He wants to do, His love, everything that he tries, everything that He gets them to do to try to keep them from heading headlong into perdition and making themselves extinct again, everything He tries is seen as mistrust. Why? Because they're afraid of Him. He doesn't love them. So they must have a hedge against it. Their guilt drives their fear, drives their mistrust, and ultimately drives their behavior to build a city, to build a tower. And in the whole thing, we hear the voice of the Master or the God that we began to worship. Did God really say, you show don't eat from the fruit? God knows that when you do, you will be like Him. And that's what He doesn't want. That's the voice of the God that we bought into. Mistrust and fear. See, Adam and Eve had to just believe God when He said, I created you in my image. Because He has to tell them after the fact, right? We know thanks to Moses writing us what happened. We know the conversation that God had within Himself said, let us make them in our image. But Adam and Eve had to trust that they were made in God's image. Now you had the new God, the fallen God, who comes to him and says, God knows that when you eat of it, you will be like Him. You're not in His image yet. Eve and Adam decided not to trust God anymore they've decided to trust Him. And that's why we find ourselves where we are. The impetus behind their new nature, the impetus behind that, always has that voice echoing through it. And I hear it in Nimrod's command. Let us make for ourselves a name. Our name. God's reaction to their reaction, which is a reaction to God's action to their reaction, all the way back to the garden. What is His action? What is He going to do about this? That's my favorite verse. My absolutely favorite verse. They did it. They've proved that they do not trust Him on a corporate level. All of humanity don't trust Him anymore. Or again, they still continue not to trust Him. And He says, you know what? I'm going to go down and take a look at the tower. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the mortals had built. It's my favorite verse. It used to be because I thought, wow, the tower is impressive enough to impress God to come down to take a look at it. That's what I used to think. I was impressed with what? I was impressed with the tower. But then it hit me somewhere along the way. Wait a minute. Did He really have to come down here to see it? No. What should make it our favorite verse is that He sees what's about to happen to humanity, and He comes down. He acts. He got off the throne and got down in the mud to create us. When it comes to you and me, God always question as to whether or not what God is going to do when humanity one more time looks at Him and says, we want you out of our face. What does He do? He shows up. That's the point of the verse. See, last week we found that the covenant was not only about His presence, but that He personally places His presence in our experience. To me, that's the beauty of the covenant. He puts Himself within humanity. He puts Himself within our timeline. And the proof of that is the promise. Remember? He said, why is the rainbow there? We used to think that it was because when we saw the rainbow, we would remember what He said. He said, no, it's when I see it, I will remember. He places Himself in our experience, if you will. He knows what's about to happen, but for Him, He doesn't experience it until it actually happens. He put Himself in your and I timeline so He could truly look at you and for us to believe that the Word could become flesh. He decided somewhere along the way that He wouldn't be complete until He was in our experience. He doesn't need to come down to see the tower. He's God. He did it for who? He did it for us. He comes walking in the garden with them. He enters into it to create them, and His actual presence sustains them. He said the rainbow was a reminder for Him to see. He remains present in our fallenness. He remains present in the midst of our destruction and in the midst of the waters of that destruction receding. When it all clears, He's still what? He's still here. There's one thing you can't speculate what it might be telling us to, is that if He did go somewhere else, look what happens whenever He goes somewhere else. If He really did withdraw His presence, look what happened. Humanity is getting ready to extinguish itself again. They're getting ready to jump, to head right towards perdition. So what does He need to do? He needs to show up again. He needs to bring His life, not just creation, but sustaining life back into our timeline. It doesn't matter to Him that it's fallen. Always remember that the covenant showed up the second day after the fall, the same way that it showed up the first day, offering the same relationship that he offered before. Before the flood, he offers the same relationship. After the flood, he's offering the same relationship. They refuse it again. They build the tower. And what does he come to do? To offer the same relationship. The covenant is the same yesterday, today, and always. It's not old. It's not new. It's him. It's his presence. So here he is, showing up again. Even after all his creation has decided to unify against his promise one more time, he still brings the promise to them. He comes to see the tower. Does he need to? No. Then why does he keep showing up? He could experience our nightmare from a distance, couldn't he? He could just sit back. He could just sit there in his foreknowledge and say, I knew what you were going through. He could let us believe he is angry and not to be trusted. He could let us believe our grandfather Nimrod when he tells us that God would never, ever love us after what we've done. So we need to take care of it. We need to do something about it. He could just sit back and watch us die. And if anybody asked him, he would say, I warned him. I told you so. I told them so. But he shows up offering what he's offered. The covenant to enter our history and enter into our destruction in order to continue to offer life and love. And by the way, he doesn't just appear. He does something about it. And the Lord said, look, they're one people. They have all one language. It's the only beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from the face of the earth, left off building the city. Therefore, it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad on the face of the earth. When he says nothing they propose to do will be impossible for them, what is it that they are proposing to do? They're proposing to remove God from the equation, which will lead to their what? It will lead to their death. Like I said, he's not a jealous God who's afraid that humanity is using technology to build something grand. That isn't the point. Their purpose is to remove him from the equation. Their purpose is to kill themselves and to kill their children. They're proposing that everyone die. And as with the last time that they looked to destroy humanity, he intervened. Human's nature is still the same. The flood bought humanity time, but it didn't change their natures, apparently. They're planning their own extinction again. The point is that God cares enough to intervene. He doesn't just appear in human history, he acts in human history. Confusing their speech is an act of mercy, just as the flood was. The tower was a fully human enterprise based on mistrust and fear of God. It seemed right, but it will lead to their what? It'll lead to their death. Their unity and success leads them to forget their humanity. They forget the image that they were created. They are now all in it for themselves. The problem with human reasoning of the tower is there's no room for God to speak and to be present. Their fear is still in place. And if you think that fear can change somebody's mind, if you think fear can change somebody's heart, they just lived through probably the most fearful experience in the history of humanity, and it changed them not one bit. Fear might get us to do something preserving, but it never what? It never changes the heart. Which is why it can't be used to get somebody to worship God. He asked them to trust him. It was merciful. he still offers life. They still choose fear. So Babel, therefore, it says that it was called Babel. And in Hebrew, it is automatically translated as Babylon or Babylonian. But it has, in Akkadian, the literal translation of Babel is a gateway to God, or a doorway to God, if you will. And what they think may have happened, what it's possible right here, but we're not 100% sure, is that the author, that Moses kind of liked the sound or a play on words, and because there's a Hebrew word that is close to Babel, and that is Baal, and that means to mix or to confuse. So we're not 100% sure. Babel, though, from now on, after this, it is mentioned 262 times in the Hebrew Scriptures. But it will not be mentioned after this. It won't be mentioned again until 2 Kings. And in 2 Kings, it is translated as Babylon. And it will be translated as Babylon from here on out. Out of the 262 times, it's only translated as Babel 3 times. And it's all before 2 Kings. And by the way, the section in 2 Kings is when Hezekiah gets deathly ill, and Babylon sends condolences by way of some ambassadors, if you will. Two ambassadors come from Babylon. Like I said, you go from Babel in Genesis all the way to 2 Kings. You don't hear them again until they show up with condolences from the king of Babylon. And Hezekiah is so impressed with them that he shows them everything. He takes them through the treasury. He takes them to the house of God. He takes them through everything. You think, okay, well, no problem. He's just being diplomatic. Until Isaiah showed up the next day and says, what did you show them? And Hezekiah says, I showed him everything. And Isaiah says, they're going to carry away everything one day that you own. And in a perfect representation of Nimrod, Hezekiah says, no problem. Nebuchadnezzar will then indeed show up, right? He will show up. The Lord gave King Joash, king of Judah, in his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to where? The land of Shinar. And he placed the vessels in the treasury of his what? Of his gods. Shinar remains a what? It remains a divine place. Something divine took place here. And everybody who settles it after this makes sure that it stays what? That it stays divine. That it stays to be a place for worship in order to take place. Daniel 1 tells us that. Shinar is still associated with the gods that have worshipped in Babylon ever since the tower. Nebuchadnezzar is the latest incarnation of the fallen human nature, the latest incarnation of Nimrod taking what they want. Now seen as divine, as godlike. Babylon will now be prophetically shown from here throughout Scripture, all the way to the book of Revelation. Babylon will now be prophetically shown as the ultimate plan of the false creator, the ultimate plan of the false god. Babylon will be associated with worship of the false god. Just the name is all you need. Ones that will exercise the human evolutionary power of fallen humanity and call it divine. Either believing that God acts through them, or at least believing that God is on our side. And that he's on our side because might makes right. Daniel accuses sin, the rest of the language. He brought some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility. He didn't bring the poor and the starving from Jerusalem. Who'd he bring? He brings the nobility. He brings the strong. He brings the rich. Young men without physical defect, handsome, he taught the literature of the language of the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were wise men in the ways of divinity, if you will. all of the gods, all of the stars, all of those worship practices. The Chaldeans do it all. He takes men of no defect, young men of no defect, and what's the language of that? When's the only time that somebody is brought in to look at divine power, but they have to be first of no defect? The priesthood. Nebuchadnezzar is making what? He's enlisting priests. Why? Because he's the new God. Endowed and given to his grandfather Nimrod. He assigns them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. The palace master then gives them other names. He's their new creator. He's their new God. Babylon becomes the label of worship of a false god. Of what a power, a military power, a might, an emperor, a king that Nebuchadnezzar can come together and bring it all together and claim that all of this is divine. Claim that this is God doing this. God is on my side. When he walked into the temple in Jerusalem and took everything, he was telling Jerusalem, he was telling Judah, look, I didn't just defeat your army, I defeated your God. By the way, it is the genesis, if you will, it's the seed of not having a separation between church and state. Government says, I'll take you prisoner. And by the way, I have the power of God to do it. Babylon becomes the label of this worship of a false god. The one who conquers, the one who forces, the one who terrorizes, the bully who bullies people into worshiping him. He can't do it out of love. He can't make them love him. So he makes sure that they do. He compels them. They attribute that power at least to convince everybody that God is on their side if they don't convince you that they are God themselves. The beasts in Revelation compel worship with this power. Remember the dragon? He wanted to fight by our rules. He goes and gets more power. He goes and gets more numbers. He raises these beasts up. But look how they get them to worship him. They wage war on the saints. To what? To conquer them. He's given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. How much? Again, the whole world is in danger of what? In danger of worshiping a God that cannot bring them life. And it was allowed, the second beast, it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be what? To be killed. Fall in love with me, I'll kill you. If you don't worship me, I'll kill you. See, and if that fear gets them to do what they want, that's all they care about. I said it in prayer meeting. For the false gods, the end justifies the means. And the prophets knew, John knew, that the church would fall into this. Last week we told that the first angel came in order to call us back to his creator. Call us back to remind us that he is our creator and we were created in his image. Freedom and love, if you will. In this one now, in this particular incarnation, remember, another angel shows up. And I think that this angel, maybe not having the tower in mind, but addresses the spirit of the tower, addresses the spirit of Nimrod. Because this angel has a message for all of us. That fallen is what? Is Babylon the Great. She's made all of the nations, drink of the wine and the wrath of her prostitution. And again, the prostitution is what? World power, world domination, military, political, government, however you want to put it, empires coming together with who? Coming together with gods. Second angel is to remind us that power is already been judged and already been lost. It was judged at the ark. It was judged at the tower. This is not me, God says. If you want to worship me, quit fearing me. Don't worship me out of fear, because you're not really worshiping. If you're going to worship me out of love. That's all I got for you. All I got is I'm going to love you. I created you with free will to decide to do something with that. You can trust me and love me or what? Continue to fear me. And if you do, you, your children, and everyone else will be compelled to live by the Spirit of the tower. Babylon was judged before anyone knew what Babylon was, if you will. The center of the false creator in God, judged as fallen right here today. The covenant shows up at the tower and judges that power one more time for us to let us know that it will get us nowhere. On the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. It was defeated by the willingness of the covenant, the willingness of the covenant's creator and the covenant's keeper to stay with us in the fray, to stay with us in the destruction, to be with us as the floodwaters rose, and to be with us as the floodwaters recede. And to still be with us, even when we look him in the eye and tell him to hit the road. We got this. Because he decided that he would come down. The living, breathing covenant. The walking, talking, incarnated God, if you will. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, assuming human likeness, and being found in appearance as a human, as a man. He humbled himself, became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him even more highly and gave him the name that is above every other name. So that the name given to Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the glory of God the Father.